Well, good morning, everyone. So with it being the first Sunday of the year, I tend to have a theme to go through with sermons once a month, like 2 Corinthians last year. I've been thinking about what would be my theme through the latter parts of last year, thinking about what would be a helpful theme to go through. And a couple of you have mentioned that Ecclesiastes is your favorite book of the Bible. I don't know if that's still true now, but that at least got me thinking about Ecclesiastes, just even on a general sense. And there's other studies I've had this past year that have got me thinking about Ecclesiastes and brought up the value of that book. I've been thinking about it in relation to the work here. And the more I thought about Ecclesiastes and that it has 12 chapters, which perfectly correlates to a theme of one chapter per month, the more I thought Ecclesiastes would be a really helpful book for us all to study. And I tend to keep track of everything that I teach on, and I really haven't taught many lessons. I think I've just taught really one particular lesson on Ecclesiastes chapter 11, but besides that, it's definitely been an underutilized teaching book for me. So we're going to start with just chapter one. And like I said, it's got 12 chapters, which very conveniently means we'll just do one chapter per month through the year. And Ecclesiastes is a very different kind of book. The author of this book really just contemplates what is the meaning of life. You know, like verse 2 and 3 in chapter one, really get to the key conclusion and the key premise and the key question. And so we'll see that more in just a moment. But really, it's thinking, what really matters in life? Like, what's really most important about life? And if you really think through life, if you really pay attention, you ask the right questions, really, what's the point, right? I thought about titling this lesson something different, but I felt it was a little too abrasive. I'll bring up what I was going to title it anyway. I was going to title this lesson, "Are You Living Like an Atheist?" Because really what Solomon gets to here, if that's the author, what the preacher gets to is there's a way of seeing life under the sun that basically doesn't have any meaning whatsoever, right? And so people tend to chase things and pursue things and value things and think about things in a way that really is an illusion. And again, we'll talk more about that. But before we kind of get into the heart of the lesson, one of the things that I realized about Ecclesiastes is this is a book filled with questions. So there are 31 questions, at least in the translation I'm using. I'm sure maybe some other translations, they might choose to turn something into a question because of maybe the nature of what's being said. Suffice it to say, in the Legacy Standard Bible that I've been reading Ecclesiastes out of, there's 31 questions in 12 chapters, right? So 31 questions in 12 chapters. That means that every chapter tends to be led on by questions, right? And so I think one of the challenging things about Ecclesiastes is we're going to be challenged to ask better questions. And we're going to be challenged to ask questions we tend to want to avoid because of where it leads, questions that, although it can be uncomfortable to ask and follow through on, ultimately lead to a healthier perspective of reality and a healthy way of dealing with reality. So with that, chapter one really introduces the book by itself. So let's get right into verses 1 and 2 here. So again, Ecclesiastes 1:1 and 2, and we're mainly just going to be saying in Ecclesiastes 1 for the lesson. "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." So the interesting thing about this book is the premise, which is kind of like, what's his mission statement? What is he trying to say in this book? What is he trying to prove? Well, he starts with verse 2. This is what he's trying to prove, is everything is empty. Nothing in life really has any real meaning. And nothing is actually really satisfying. And if you go to chapter 12, verse 8, it's both the conclusion, but not quite the conclusion. So he's actually going to come back to this in chapter 12, verse 8, the last chapter near the very end of the book. You'll notice chapter 12, verse 8 nearly says exactly the same thing. "Vanity of vanity," says the preacher. all is vanity. We're going to talk more about whether or not that's really good news or bad news. But suffice it to say, that's really kind of what this book centers around. The word vanity is used 40 times in Ecclesiastes and only 33 times in every other book of the Bible combined. So this is it's a theme word in the book that conveys the idea of something being empty or it's like breath. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. But verse 1, so this is the words of the preacher, the son of David. So there's like, if you kind of look around, you kind of browse what people tend to say about Ecclesiastes, there's kind of some question marks with certain things that are said in this book, like, was it Solomon or was it one of the kings of Judah who would have been a lot like Solomon? There's a statement in chapter 1 that kind of relates to that in verse 16, where he says, he magnified and increased in wisdom more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. So it's kind of like, well, Solomon technically is only the second king in Jerusalem, so that seems to narrow it down to just David. But again, there's different ways of seeing that, where what he could be meaning is obviously, if it is Solomon, something much broader than just David. But every implication, the most simple conclusion, the most straightforward conclusion based on everything that's said in Ecclesiastes to me, and what generally seems to be agreed on, is this would be Solomon. Again, there's still some question marks, but generally it seems like it's a really fair, really simple conclusion to say it's Solomon. Now, he never says that that's who it is, because he calls himself the preacher here. And I want you to think, what's the purpose of a preacher? There's no other book of the Old Testament where the preacher is speaking to you. And I think it's helpful to think again, what is the purpose of a preacher? Why would the writer kind of title themselves that way, call themselves the preacher? And I think it's this. A preacher's role is to convince us, to persuade us, to make significant changes in our thinking or our living. Generally, biblically, a preacher presents a problem that we tend to neglect. You know, you think about in the New Testament, John the Baptist, Jesus, the apostles, whatever, you know, that the problem of sin is something that they teach on. And you have to convince people like this really is a problem that's relevant to you. And so a preacher is to convince someone of a problem that tends to be neglected or ignored. And the preacher in this book is not dealing with an Israel problem. He's not dealing with a problem of holiness or the law of Moses. The writer is just meditating on life itself. So this isn't just dealing with something that relates to an Israelite, right? This is kind of like the book of Job, where it's wisdom literature that transcends the boundaries of an Israelite culture. And in fact, there's very, very, very little said here besides references to the preacher's position. There's very little said that would be exclusively related to the Israelite nation. So again, the preacher's role is to persuade us, to get us to change our perspective, that we need to buy in to a problem so that we can start seeking the solutions that get offered, and to speak on matters of truth, right? So Solomon wouldn't just be lamenting in this book. It's not just like some diary expose. This is something that we've got to give our ear to as well. And so again, his premise in verse 2 is vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. And again, this is the premise and the conclusion, but Ecclesiastes will go further than this. It's almost like, you know, sin should be the end of the story for us. Like the conclusion is we've sinned against God and the wages of sin is death. Game over. But what God does is he creates something beyond that conclusion for us. And Ecclesiastes is the same way, right? So after chapter 12, verse 8, and really woven through the book, he eventually gets to the fact that God actually gives meaning to life, and to serve God is the thing that actually is not vanity. So after chapter 12, verse 8, he says, the end of the matter is this, fear God, keep his commandments, for this is man's all. And what he's saying is, that is the thing that actually has value and meaning beyond the vanity of life under the sun. But the idea of vanity, again, it's like breath, right? So it got cold enough this morning where when I breathed going to my car, I could see my breath. But how long did that last? Like, it appeared in front of my face and it vanished. And what Solomon is trying to say is everything in life under the sun, right? When he says under the sun, he's thinking kind of atheistically. Like, if you're to think about the sphere of our existence apart from God, apart from eternity, just life as it is here, what do you get? Like, what is real? And he says it's all like breath. It's all like a mirage. The more questions you ask, the more you investigate the data honestly, the more you find everything is a mirage. What looks to have significance and kind of form from a distance, the closer you get, it just ends up vanishing and fading, and you're left with nothing real, nothing substantial. Everything fades away, right? So that's what he's going to be supporting through this. And I want you to think, too, when do someone else's conclusions have the power to change you? And I want to illustrate this with, like, when I'm traveling into a different area, I tend to look up coffee shops. And since me traveling, if I'm passing through, I've really just got one opportunity to go to a coffee shop. What do you think I do to find the best coffee shop I can find? I get my Maps app out. I look at Yelp. And what I want to see is I want to see a 4.5 or 5-star reviewed coffee shop. And not just with like 20 reviews, 15 reviews. I want to see hundreds of reviews for a coffee shop. And if it's like 4.5, 5 stars, 200 or 300 reviews, that's where I'm going. You know, so we do that kind of thing with, you know, food and purchases because we want to make sure we're making the right decision, right? We want to make sure that we're really spending our best effort when we're spending money or purchasing something for ourselves. So again, we'll investigate and we'll ask questions about those little things like coffee or restaurants. But yet with life, which is so much more significant and so much more consequential, we hardly ask the right kind of questions. And, you know, there's a worldview that actually fits what Solomon says here. It's called nihilism. And nihilism is the idea, it's a worldview that nothing matters, nothing has any real value, you know, nothing's going to change anything ever. And so it's, again, to kind of put it in its etymology, like its word meaning, nihilism is the idea of, I think it's nihil or nihili, it's nothingness, and ism is like the theology of it. So it's like a nothingness belief system is basically the literal meaning is nothing matters, nothing has value, everything's imaginary. And you know that's right. It's actually correct. But what Solomon is going to do, he's going to help us see those things, but actually lead us to conclusions where, again, there's a higher level of meaning. But kind of getting to this again, when does someone else's conclusions change you? With that illustration of coffee, if someone leaves a review where they talk about the coffee, they clearly know what they're talking about. They're appealing to me because, you know, I really like coffee a lot. I know how to describe it. And if someone's kind of speaking my language and they leave a really high review, boom, I'm probably going to go there because their review spoke my language. And the same with Solomon, right? Solomon is doing a thorough investigation with wisdom we can trust. He's a person we can trust. He's inspired by God. And so I want you to think this book isn't just meant to be a general ambiguous lament. Again, this is meant to change the way that we think in substantial ways so that we stop living like an atheist, so that our values aren't just built on chasing the wind and we deal with reality as it really is. And again, is this good news or bad news? The fact that everything is vanity. And I'd say it depends. You know, if I was using my refrigerator and hoping to use it like an oven, where you came over to my house and I was really frustrated, and I was like, you know what? I keep putting food in here and I'm trying to heat it up. And every time I put my food in there, it cools it down. Would you be giving me bad news by telling me like, dude, that's a refrigerator. The design of that is to cool your food, not heating up. It's literally doing the opposite of what you're trying to make it do. You know, no matter as hard as you might try, unless you, I don't know, dramatically modify refrigerator. Anyway, it's not going to heat up your food, right? And so it'd be good news to help someone if they're beating their head against a wall trying to get something out of something that it can't give. It can't do that. And you say, no, this is what you're looking for. That's good news, right? Wouldn't you want someone to tell you you're wasting your time and your energy on things? that aren't worth what you're investing. And one last way of talking about this with Ecclesiastes, is this good news or bad news and how it depends? I'm studying with someone right now. We just have begun studying 1 Peter together, but when we talk, what he's mentioned to me is the first book of the Bible that he ended up reading was Ecclesiastes. Comes from a military background. And he actually told me that in the military, he was a nihilist. He believed nothing matters, that life has no meaning. So he read Ecclesiastes and he said, that book spoke my language. You know, I already agreed with the premise. Yeah, life is meaningless. But you know what Ecclesiastes did for him? It helped him see that, yes, life under the sun is meaningless, but God gives meaning where there was meaningless before. And now he's read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We're studying 1 Peter, and he's developing faith. And it's because he started with Ecclesiastes, and this wasn't depressing for him. He wasn't depressed by hearing all his vanity. He was encouraged because, again, of where it led him, right? The conclusion doesn't stop there in Ecclesiastes. So, again, it depends. For God to tell us we're sinners, condemned to hell, is that good news or bad news? It depends. Is that where we stop? Are we willing to hear that? Are we willing to listen to where that's going to lead? Or do we just avoid and neglect what God is trying to do with that truth, right? We can't escape it. We can just maybe navigate it in a more productive way. Same thing here. So verse 3 through 11, let me read this. What advantage or profit does man have in all his labor in which he labors under the sun? That is a key question to this book. Basically, what's the point? What do you get out of life? Out of all your labors. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth stands forever. Also the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, rises there again. Going toward the south and circling toward the north, the wind goes circling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers go into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers go, there they continually go. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to speak of it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see this, it is new? Already it has been for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things which will be. There will be for them no remembrance among those who are still to come later. Again, this can seem like bad news, but I would argue, you know, it's good news if we're willing to accept it and where it leads with wisdom. Because again, I want you to think about this. Does wisdom, healthy wisdom, emphasize a problem without solutions? Does healthy wisdom focus on a problem without also seeking or offering alternatives? So again, although Ecclesiastes is presenting a multitude of problems, the point of that isn't to leave you there or just frustrate you. The problem is to emphasize something that leads us to an alternative and to be open to the actual solution to these inevitable problems. So the question in verse 3 is, anything actually achieved or gained in all our work under the sun? And again, under the sun, meaning taking God out of the picture, anything higher out of the picture, just atheistically, life as it is here under the sun. And I want you to think about this question because this is really important. I want to illustrate it this way. When I worked at UPS, something they told me when I was hired into the company is that it's unionized. And because UPS was a unionized company, that meant that as an employee of the union, you had to pay your dues, meaning like financially. So what they warned me and the group of new hires with us, they said, the way that this works out is what can happen, not guaranteed, but what can happen is all of the union dues might compile together in one paycheck, and you might work a week where your paycheck is zero. Why did they tell us that? Because some people got that paycheck that said zero. And they weren't expecting that. And UPS is a labor job. It is hard work. So when someone's caught off guard, hey, I've got a paycheck here, it says zero? You know, I worked all this time and I'm getting nothing? You know what they did? They quit. They quit the company. Because they're, in their mind, I didn't work for free, for nothing. I expect something to be in my hand. And again, we care a lot about that for our jobs in the workforce. You know, if I asked you, hey, would you work what you're doing? Would you do what you're doing for free? I would imagine most of us would say no. You know, you work day after day, you labor, at the end of the week, no money, no paycheck. Still got to buy food, still got to live your life, still got to pay the bills, no money. No, you'd look for employment elsewhere. Because there's things that happen that give context to everything that you did with your labor. And what Solomon's going to get to is death reflects back, ultimately, and the inevitability of the fact that we're going to die puts everything else in perspective before that. So again, the question is anything ultimately achieved? And the first thing he focuses on is lessons from nature that get neglected. Really simple stuff. Verse 4, generations come, generations go. Earth is the same. Verse 5, sun rises and sets, goes right back where it came from. Does anything change? Is the sun going to come up in the south tomorrow? Or the north? Is it going to go into some new location? No, it's just the same thing. Verse 6, the wind goes on its circular courses. Verse 7, the rivers are real busy, going and going and going, but the sea never fills up. Just keeps going back where it comes from and keeps going and going. And the idea is this, nothing's changing. You know, if you observe reality honestly, you've got a lot of activity. You've got a lot of movement. A lot of things are happening. You know, creation is a very busy thing. But is anything ultimately being truly achieved? Is like some goal being worked towards in creation in the day and night cycle? No. Nothing's changing. It's the same thing. The idea is this. Does nature encourage an achievement-based way of thinking? Does nature encourage us to think that there's some great dramatic thing we can do to change life or change the nature of life? No. You know, it's kind of like a carousel, a merry-go-round. You know, you get on like the pretty little horse or unicorn or whatever mystical animal they might have that you can get on. And you go around and around and around and it's really fun, but at some point you get off the ride and you step off where you got on. You were moving around, but you didn't go anywhere. And I want you to think about this again to kind of illustrate what he's observing from nature. So I haven't played Monopoly very much, but I recently played Monopoly when I visited Indiana with some people, and the game lasted a really long time and got really emotional. But would you play Monopoly if the rules were you go around the board, right? You buy properties, you get or lose money, whatever. But as soon as you pass go, everything you did resets. The properties you bought, they go back. The money you gained back in the bank, you know, everything just resets. And so you go around, but in one go, you can't get enough properties to do anything meaningful. You know, if you came into a Monopoly game, if I went into a Monopoly game or that was the house rules, I'd say, what's the point? You know, this defeats the whole purpose of the game. Like, it's not even worth playing at this point. And what the preacher is saying is, that's what life is screaming at us. That everything that everybody does, it just resets. And if we're to think through the game of life, nothing is amounting to anything. Nothing meaningful is getting done. Nothing is being achieved. And life is telling that to you. But we're just not paying attention. And verse 8 through 11, all things are wearisome. You know, the eye's not satisfied with seeing or the ear with hearing. You know, the things we see, the things we hear, we think things are going to satisfy us. We believe things are better than what they really are. And I want to illustrate it this way. Did you know that eating celery costs more calories than the celery even gives you? So they did like a scientific study on this. They had someone in a room, and I don't know how they measured the calories, but somehow they did it. And they measured the calories it was taking to eat and digest the celery. Was that more or less than the celery itself? And it was actually requiring more calories to eat celery. So I want to think, okay, let's say someone is starving. They're really hungry. And you give them a huge bowl of celery. Is that going to satisfy them? And what if they think like, well, maybe I need to eat more celery. So they use both of their hands and they start eating as much as they can. It doesn't matter. Like as much celery as you can eat, it's basically like water in the form of a solid. It's nothing. So you eat it and you eat it. You're getting hungrier and hungrier. And you could illustrate this in all sorts of ways, like salt water. If you're at sea and you get really thirsty, you drink salt water, it's only going to make you thirstier. And that's the thing about life in verse 8. The things we think are going to satisfy us, they really don't. You know, you do something and you feel good about it and you're glad. And by the way, Ecclesiastes will acknowledge it's possible to be glad with your achievements. But I want you to look at chapter 2, verse 10 and 11. It's where Solomon will acknowledge you can get gladness from things you do, but it just fades so quickly. So verse 10, all that my eyes asked for, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any gladness, for my heart was glad because of all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. So Solomon's saying, like, I was glad. I enjoyed what I did. Verse 11, thus I turned to all my works which my hands had done and the labor which I had labored to do. And this is where, when it says he turned, he's really considering, okay, it's over now. So let me think about this. Let me think about what this has given me, how I feel about this. Let me be honest about this now that it's done. Verse 11, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no advantage under the sun. And look at verse 17. As he continues like asking questions and not just getting drunk on the temporary gladness of his achievements, as he really thinks through this, as he really thinks about this with wisdom in verse 17, where does he quickly get after he says, I was glad in everything I did? A few verses later, verse 17, so I hated life. For the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me because everything is vanity and striving after the wind. So back to chapter 1, verse 8, all things are wearisome. You know, everything you're trying to do, everything people think is new, you know, he's not talking about technology, you know, iPhones or cars. What he's talking about is the nature of life, the things being considered within the context of this book. The stuff people have realized about life in the past is going to get realized all over again. What people learn about humanity and human nature is going to be the same thing with the next generation. The problems that bother people about life now are going to bother people again. The things people tried to do to solve those problems are going to get done again. And then it's going to become ineffective after a generation. And just, again, it just keeps repeating that the solutions people tried to pursue, they kind of fade away. The understanding people had is now gone and someone has to discover it all over again. So again, in verse 2, he's not talking about phones or cars or technology or electricity. He's thinking about the nature of life and humanity. Is anyone really changing anything? And I want you to think, have iPhones and cars and electricity, has that changed the nature of humanity? Has that changed generally the principal struggles we face in life, the questions we still ask? Has that changed the meaning of life, the purpose of our existence? No. You know, those things have not ultimately offered anything new. Technology is different, but in terms of what's being considered, it's really just the same thing in a different day. And again, is this bad news or good news? For him to just say outright, look, everything's wearisome. You know, you're going to work because you've got to work. You know, life is hard. Life is cruel. Life is unfair. And that's just how it is. Life is going to exhaust you. Good news or bad news? Go to chapter 11. The verses I've actually done a lesson on of anything in Ecclesiastes. Chapter 11, verses 9 through 10. I would argue it's good news. That it's better to accept and learn to work with reality rather than kick against it and get all disgruntled when reality shows its ugly face. Chapter 11, 9 and 10, what the preacher is doing here, we'll try to unpack a little bit, but basically he's saying, learn these lessons as young as possible. Learn it as young as possible that life is vexing and difficult and meaningless under the sun, and learn to navigate that productively. 11, verse 9, be glad, young man, during your childhood. And he's not saying like, you know, it doesn't mean anything, you know, be glad, but good luck. No, he's meaning really, really be glad, young man, during your childhood. Let your heart be merry. Really be glad during the days of your manhood. Walk in the ways of your heart in the sight of your eyes. Yet, don't ignore this. Know that God will bring you into judgment for all these things, because again, God is the one who gives life meaning. His commands, his instructions and warnings are what give life their substance. Verse 10, here is the key thing. So, remove vexation from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, because childhood and the prime of life are vanity. Now, verse 10, he isn't saying in the context of the book leading up to this point, he's not saying avoid pain, you know, or ignore, you know, anger or ignore difficult things in life. What he's saying is, when you're confronted with life's weariness, deal with it in a godly way. Don't let yourself become embittered. Don't be surprised when life is hard. Don't be caught off guard when something is difficult and overwhelming. Deal with it in a godly way, right? So that's what Ecclesiastes is getting to. Yes, all things are wearisome. But if we work with that reality productively, there's joy through it. But not if we think life is something it's not. Not if we kick against reality, right? So, 12 through 18, let's finish the chapter. I, the preacher, have been king over Jerusalem. I gave my heart to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous endeavor which God has given to the sons of men, which to occupy themselves. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, striving after the wind. What is bent cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I spoke within my heart, saying, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over me or over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has seen an abundance of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and simple-minded folly. I came to know that this also is striving after the wind, because in much wisdom there is much vexation, and whoever increases knowledge increases pain. Again, very depressing. But what Solomon is doing immediately is he's closing doors to open the better ones. He's saying, look, fulfillment, if you're looking for meaning or fulfillment or like real substantial joy in these places, forget it. I'm telling you. I looked into it. I thought about it completely and thoroughly. I asked every question you can ask. I was not biased. And I'm telling you, it's grievous and doesn't amount to anything. And I want you to think verse 22, or verse 12 rather. Solomon was king. If he wanted something, he could have it. He had authority that was extremely unique, not just as king, but king over Israel. You know, in verse 13, he gave himself to look at everything that could be examined. Verse 14, he claims to have seen all the works which are done. And in verse 16, you know, Solomon was someone of incredible wisdom. God said no one would have Solomon's wisdom before or after. Solomon's qualified to make these assessments. You know, and Solomon throughout this book is always intellectually, philosophically, and emotionally honest with his questions. You know, I've listened to talks about things like nihilism, that life is meaningless, but to end their talks on like a positive note, they have to be dishonest about their conclusions and premise. They've got to say something that is philosophically, emotionally, intellectually inconsistent with the worldview they've established. Solomon is going to, in wisdom, never betray his premise and conclusion that everything's wearisome, everything's vanity. He's going to maintain integrity and honesty with those conclusions. And so again, everything people do, everything people seek to achieve, it's grievous, it's pointless, and it's vexing. And again, is this good news or bad news? You know, if you're wasting your time, resources, and energy on something that can't give you what you're hoping to get from it, and they offer you an alternative to get what you're looking for somewhere else, is that good news or is it bad news? Again, Solomon is simply closing doors that we walk through, that we expend ourselves looking for something that isn't even there. So again, the conclusion is Solomon has listed his unique qualifications. Verse 13, everything's grievous. Verse 14, everything's vanity and chasing wind. Verse 15, there are many things that are bent that can never be straightened, things that are broken that can never be fixed, things that are lacking that can never be changed. And I want you to think about it this way. This is an illustration I heard from someone else on Ecclesiastes, and I thought this was really, really helpful. So the illustration is this. Imagine an airplane is going down and it's about to crash, and someone is in this airplane, and let's say it's got 5 minutes before it crashes, and someone uses the bathroom, and they get out of the bathroom, and they start yelling at everybody, "The bathroom light is broken! Someone's got to get in there and fix it!" Is that the most important thing? The plane is going to crash, that the bathroom light that's broken, that someone get in there and start fixing that? You know, maybe in some other context where there's no other bigger problems going on, but if a plane is going down, isn't it really vanity and just kind of a waste of energy and time to focus on something so meaningless? And again, what Solomon is doing is he's asking questions that really expose the real value of something in a truthful and honest context. Does it matter in the context of being able to ask the right questions and analyze things honestly without getting lost in temporary delusions and believing things that just aren't even true about life and about things and about achievements? So there's problems that are inevitable. There's issues that are unavoidable. You know, there's things that are unfulfilling and they're never going to be fulfilling. You try to get more and more, it's never going to make it fulfilling. You know, there's problems about life and governments. No one's ever going to fix it. No matter how many riots, no matter how many protests, no matter the integrity of politicians that might be in one office at one time and another. There are problems that God designed in verse 15. God designed things in the world to stay broken. God designed things in life to be unfulfilling. Why did he do that? Because we need to seek what is outside of the sun. Because meaning doesn't come from life itself, and we are designed to seek what is outside of life itself. So in practical terms, it's not that we didn't go on vacation long enough in terms of fulfillment and joy and just feeling finally just satisfied and good and I got it. It's not that we didn't go on vacation long enough. It's not that we don't take enough vacations. It's not that our career isn't good enough. It's not that our relationships, we don't have enough people around us. It's not that we don't have enough of an income. It's not that we need more money. It's not that we don't get enough relaxing time and leisure time. You know, in Ecclesiastes, what he's saying is none of those things ultimately satisfy you. None of those things are going to give you what you're trying to get out of it. And the more you just think that's the thing that I need to finally get it and be happy and things to be okay, it's a mirage. And none of those things are what really satisfy us. So the more you increase knowledge, the more you realize this is a problem, that's a lie, that's an illusion, that person's wasting their time. The more you increase in wisdom, the more you realize just how broken and meaningless everything is. With much knowledge comes much vexation and pain. Good news or bad news? Can it be helpful to deal with that reality? Can it be helpful to be honest enough to work through that? Isaiah 53, Jesus was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Why was that? Was Jesus a joyful person? You know, did Jesus have meaning and fulfillment in his life? But Jesus was a man of sorrows. He saw problems that other people didn't see. But you know, he saw solutions other people didn't see. I want you to go to Matthew 11, and this is where we're going to end the lesson here. Matthew 11, and just verses 28 through 30. You know, and ultimately Ecclesiastes is a very gospel-centered book. You know, Ecclesiastes is like every other book of the Bible, where it ultimately is pointing to Jesus. And it's doing that in a philosophical way, right? It's not a book saying, here's who the Messiah will be. But do you think Jesus believed that life was ultimately meaningless under the sun? You know, did Jesus try to fix problems about life that can't be fixed? Did Jesus come to fix economic problems? Did he come to fix Israel's economy or government system? You know, people who were healed of their sickness, they were still going to die. You know, do you think Jesus didn't believe the truths of Ecclesiastes, that ultimately life is not about achieving something under the sun? Life is all about seeking God and finding what only He can give. That's why Jesus came. Jesus is the fulfillment of everything we saw in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. And in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, Jesus offers this invitation to people who get it, that life is wearisome, that life is grievous, that life does not have meaning and substance apart from God. Jesus says this, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest," that is, satisfaction, "for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Life is hard. Life is harsh. Life is wearisome. Life cannot give you what you ultimately need. Jesus acknowledges that in this verse, and he's offering an alternative, if we'll listen. Ecclesiastes will lead us closer to Jesus, if we'll listen. Ecclesiastes will help us appreciate unseen things, if we will listen, right? Jesus came for the people who get the point of Ecclesiastes. Let's pray for these things, and then I'll offer the invitation after the prayer.